And to confront this crisis, you saw that. It was a big deal 2 months ago. I declared a national emergency, which is what it is. This is an invasion. When you see these caravans starting out with 20,000 people, that's an invasion. I was badly criticized for using the word invasion. It's an invasion. And it's also an invasion of drugs coming in from Mexico, okay? It's an invasion of drugs. I mean, when you have 15,000 people marching up and you have hundreds and hundreds of people and you have two or three border security people that are brave and great, and don't forget, we don't let them, and we can't let them use weapons. We can't. Other countries do. We can't. I would never do that. But how do you stop these people? You can't. There's no... That's only in the panhandle you can get away with that statement.
Hello, and welcome to the Reason Editors podcast. I am guest host Peter Suderman, filling in for Matt Welch, who is on a secret European adventure. I am joined today by my colleagues Catherine Mengu Ward and Nick Gillespie, as well as guest Eric Baim. Everyone say hello.
Hello, friend.
Hello.
Hi, Peter.
That clip you just heard was President Donald Trump in May of this year speaking in Panama City, Florida, which is not too far from where I grew up. At the very end of that clip, you hear him say, well, how are we going to stop them? And it's a little bit hard to hear what is happening in the crowd, but somebody from the crowd yells out, shoot them. And Trump says, well, only in the panhandle, folks. Sadly and unfortunately, someone appears to have taken that idea, at least, to heart over the weekend in El Paso, Texas. 21-year-old Patrick Crucius killed 20 people in a Walmart in El Paso, in and around a Walmart in El Paso, and then less than 24 hours later, 24-year-old Connor Betts killed 9 people outside a bar in Dayton, Ohio. Both of these incidents appear to have left digital trails. The El Paso shooter left a manifesto railing against immigration and announcing that, quote, this attack is a response to the Hispanic invasion of Texas. He also wrote that his views predate Trump and said that Trump did not inspire them. But he did say, you know, if we can get enough, in the manifesto, he said, if we can get rid of enough people, then our way of life can become more sustainable. His manifesto was anti-corporate, anti-immigrant, pro-environment, and also sort of strangely talked about workers being replaced by machines. The Dayton shooter, 24-year-old Connor Betts, also left a stream of tweets, including really kind of horrifically liking tweets about the El Paso shooting, encouraging people to vote blue on the 2nd of November in 2018. That was the midterm last year. And then perhaps most notably in February of 2018 last year, he tweeted at Senator Rob Portman of Ohio, a Republican, hey, Rob, how much did they pay you to look the other way? 17 kids are dead. If not now, when? That was the day of the mass shooting at Parkland, Florida. So we are unfortunately going to be talking about this horrific and tragic weekend and the shootings. Nick, I want to start with you. These are inevitably political events. They would be political events even if the shooters did not intend them as such. You have often made the case over the years that libertarianism is a kind of a comprehensive and all-purpose worldview. It has something to say about everything. What do libertarian politics and what do libertarians have to say about these shootings specifically and about this sort of attack generally, which always makes news and always causes broad political and cultural discussion in the aftermath?
Yeah, it's, you know, first and foremost is the sense of empathy and feeling for people who, you know, the victims of this and their families. I mean, this is, mass shootings are not increasing in number, according to analysts who look at this. They are in the severity or the number of casualties or the number of deaths. And it's important to keep in mind a large pattern or trend over the past 20, 25 years of a decrease in gun violence and gun deaths, other than suicides, which are increasing. But I think you see in the shooter's manifesto, particularly the El Paso shooter, a rejection of a kind of understanding of a pluralism and tolerance in America and a willingness to kind of live in a world that is constantly changing, that is profoundly anti-libertarian. This is not a referendum in any way shape or form on libertarian thought, but it is paradigmatic of a worldview that sees everything in terms of zero-sum games, everything in terms of an invasion, and that if somebody feels that their world is going away, that it is just darkness and that they need to, you know, they need to wipe out the invaders. The shooter in El Paso specifically referenced the Great Replacement, which is a theory from a French kind of neo-Nazi who worries about white ethno-states. And this is something that we need to confront and combat and rebut at every level of society. And I think that somebody like Donald Trump, and the shooter is very explicit that all of his views and all of his predilections predate Trump. But Trump and people like Trump are not helping when they demonize and when they dehumanize immigrants as well as people around the world. So I think, you know, what libertarianism, you know, can comment on this is that the worldview that we have is one that would make this impossible. Because people wouldn't be feeling this way, but we need to do a better job of kind of creating those moments of empathy with a world that is changing, both for the people who are showing up here, but also the people who are feeling displaced.
Catherine, every time a shooting like this happens, and they happen with a horrific regularity, the result is calls for action from politicians, from pundits, from the kind of commentary class. We've already seen calls for gun control from Democratic candidates, not surprisingly. But this morning, President Trump tweeted, "We cannot let those killed in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio die in vain. Likewise, for those so seriously wounded, we can never forget them. And those many who came before them, Republicans and Democrats must come together and get strong background checks, perhaps marrying that legislation with desperately needed immigration reform. We must have something good, if not great, come out of these two tragic events." So I have a couple of questions here for you. One is, how much responsibility does someone like Trump, who laughs at a joke about, it was a joke, I think, but it was a pretty horrific, awful joke about shooting immigrants, who calls immigrants invaders, how much responsibility does he have for an event like this? And two, what, if anything, should politicians do in response to this? And what can they do?
It will make a perfect kind of political sense if we end up passing substantial gun control in this country under a Republican president. Like, that to me is the main takeaway as a libertarian. It's just like, yes, of course that's what will happen. Of course, you know, one of our biggest entitlements prior to Obamacare was Medicare Part D. That was passed under a Republican. The idea that in pursuit of an anti-immigration agenda, Donald Trump will casually let go something that the Republican Party has been quite principled on for many, many years is absolutely fitting with our current political moment. For your question about the extent to which Donald Trump should take blame or bears blame, I will say I'm kind of, and the fact that this is even a sentence I'm about to say is bad on a thousand levels for our country. But I'm inclined to take the shooter at his word in his manifesto. When he says, "Donald Trump didn't make me like this," I think we should believe him. And I think the Dayton shooter reinforces that. This Dayton shooter didn't say anything about Trump. He said the opposite. He said, "Vote blue." He said, "You know, I'm in favor of gun control." He said, "Political dream team" about Elizabeth Warren and Kamala Harris. There's, you know, I am inclined to take the shooter's own words at face value in this respect and say, Donald Trump didn't do this. Now, Donald Trump was elected by people who share the views of the first shooter. So it's not as if this isn't a real cultural current and Donald Trump isn't an avatar of it. He is. At the same time, I generally think people give politicians too much credit and too much blame for anything that happens in the world, and we should be cautious here.
But can I just throw in, though, I mean, Trump is responsible for his rhetoric, and his rhetoric is not simply, you know, like bad or unseemly or disappointing. I mean, it's deeply, deeply disturbing and dehumanizing. And the way that he talks about immigrants, like, you know, that has to stop. If somebody like Justin Amash, the Michigan congressman who was a Republican and became an independent, you know, it's partly because of the hate the way that Donald Trump talks about stuff. And like, we really do need to demand better of him. I don't think he is responsible any more than, you know, video games are responsible. And of course, a couple of Republican Congress people, you know, or elected officials immediately went to blame video games for the carnage. Video games aren't responsible. Donald Trump isn't responsible, but Donald Trump is responsible for, you know, how he talks about things. And it's certainly not helping any kind of conversation, any kind of policy discussion.
Yeah, I think we've sort of had this discussion for a while now of whether Donald Trump is cause or effect of the Trumpist movement and the Trump moment that we're living in. And it really is, again, an example here of how he is kind of both. Trump is president because people who, you know, are the people that would stand up at that rally and yell, shoot immigrants, and think that's a funny joke. Those people exist independent of Donald Trump being president. They will continue to exist once he leaves office. He is a consequence of that sort of part of our politics and our culture. But then I think Nick is right that he's, you know, his rhetoric and his unwillingness to shut down that kind of thing, certainly. And the way that he plays to nationalism, I think when you read the manifesto of the shooter, I think we need a better word for this than manifesto, because that doesn't really capture it. It was not an intellectual document by any means.
Well, and I do want to note that the shooter himself describes his own manifesto as meh.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, he's right.
It's not very good.
His review of his own manifesto.
It's not, it's not, you know, it's very much, it's just sort of an angry, lonely screed against immigrants primarily are scapegoated. But as Peter said earlier, there's a lot of villains that the shooter had in mind. And I think it's just, you know, it really is this sense of nationalism taken to an extreme. And Trump's rhetoric certainly plays into that. The idea that you could look at people who are peacefully shopping in a Walmart, many of them probably shopping for back to school supplies for their children, whether they're immigrants or Americans or whatever. That's a fundamentally American activity. They were engaging in peaceful commerce in one of the most iconic American brands. And you could see those people as enemies of the country or of the nation, whatever it is you think you're defending. I wrote on Saturday that it's the act of a madman. And I don't think anything we've learned since then has changed that opinion.
I also think if what we're saying, if one of our, you know, I think a thing that that Reason magazine broadly has added to this conversation and continues to add to this conversation is to continue to note the fact that the number of mass shootings is not up, and that even though we are, you know, we are living in a world that where the background is a decrease in gun violence, a decrease in interpersonal violence, etc., like, we can't actually have both these things be true. It can't be true that the number of mass shootings is not up and Donald Trump's violent rhetoric is increasing the number of mass shootings.
Eric, you mentioned nationalism, so I want to talk a little bit about nationalists, in particular one, Sourabh Amari, who works at the New York Post, who tweeted this morning, "Military-grade weapons should have no place in our streets." In a historic cover editorial, the New York Post comes out in favor of banning assault weapons, period, now, period. That editorial, I thought, it was notable that it admits that the label assault weapons doesn't actually describe a clear class of guns, and that studies showed that the last ban, which was in effect from 94 to 2004, had a limited impact. So this is a call for an assault weapons ban that has, that they say it's not clear what types of weapons would be banned or what the actual impact on gun violence would be. But just prognosticate for me a little bit. Are we about to witness a shift in the Republican Party driven by a kind of Trumpian desire to restrict immigration on the one hand, as Catherine was saying, and the nationalists' desire to get out in front of the gun issue on the other hand? Are we about to see a shift in the Republican Party on Second Amendment issues?
Yeah, I think it's possible we're going to see a shift in part of the Republican Party. I think it's interesting that tweet got ratioed to heck this morning, and that Amari actually responded to someone making fun of that fact by pointing out that it's also, this is his tweet, quote, "It's also the paper most likely to be sitting on POTUS's desk, so ... basically making the point that he thinks he's got the ear of President Donald Trump, and he may very well be right. I think this editorial and this tweet and Amari's sort of perspective on this is very useful because it's actually pretty intellectually honest. There's been a lot of talk in recent weeks about this new national conservatism, and there's been lots of flowery language and pseudo-intellectual wrappings put around this, and Amari really kicked that off himself back in May with the Against David Frenchism op-ed that ran in First Things. And, you know, the goal of this that he says in there, the goal of this new conservative project is to enjoy a public square reordered to the common good. And that sounds, I think, pretty innocuous, maybe
at first. The common good and
even the highest good.
Capitalized.
Correct.
Almost Trump style.
I think the worst that brings to mind is maybe like a bad government redevelopment project. Like they're going to put down some paving stones and plant some trees and maybe build a too expensive bus shelter. And that's the public square that they're going to reorder. But actually what they're talking about here is authoritarianism. And that comes through pretty clearly when they're calling for a ban on weapons that are that they even admit is not based in reality, but is rather just based in feelings primarily over facts. And this is always one of the first projects of authoritarians is to disarm the public. And I think this kind of cuts to the core of one aspect of this new national conservatism that we're seeing is that it really is just sort of old right-wing style authoritarianism that's come back around. And so I hope this moment, the right has been trained sort of for the last several decades to respond to any sort of attempt at eroding the Second Amendment or grabbing the guns or however you want to phrase it, has been trained sort of to respond very aggressively and negatively to that. And so I hope this will give some people on the political right who are maybe flirting with this new national conservatism idea, or maybe they like some aspects of what they've heard, this should maybe make them, you know, think twice about
it. Interesting. So you're basically positing that the longstanding defense of gun rights and opposition to gun control could itself be a bulwark against the appeal of a nationalism that's squishy.
I think Republicans that want to take on the
you have so much more. I feel like that's an oddly hopeful take. I definitely felt the opposite. Like, oh, if we're doing team nationalism here, like people will immediately throw to the wind any previously stated
people who own guns. I don't think that's their
they don't think their guns are going to get taken.
I guess that's to be seen. I think there'll be a division here between people who will again just blindly follow the president wherever he leads. There's certainly a faction of the right that would do that and will turn themselves into whatever sort of intellectual pretzel they have to make that fit within their pre-existing worldview. But I think there's going to be, and I think the way that tweet got responded to this morning, that's obviously a very small subset of American politics that I'm making that decision based on. But that, I don't know. I just, the people that I know who own guns, I don't think are going to throw aside their decades of defense of the Second Amendment for a president.
But Donald Trump already put into effect a bump stock ban after the Vegas shooting. And
he did through executive order too. Without vote in Congress.
I think, there's limits to what he can do to affect actual, gun policy and things like that. But I would expect that he's going to do something like that again, or he'll come up with something. And most Republicans and many conservatives will go along with it because there is a sense, I think, that you need to do something, whether or not it will have an actual impact or, ultimately, mass shootings are statistically rare events, so it's not clear what drives them and how to stop them, in any meaningful way from any kind of policy perspective, because all of the things that the, people, liberals or anti-gun people tend to point out or push for are things that are not going to happen or would take decades in order to have any effect in terms of taking guns out of circulation and things like that. But there will be something. And I think you'll see Republicans and conservatives going along with whatever Trump decides to do on this.
So we've often talked about shootings with respect to Second Amendment issues, but they have increasingly become First Amendment issues as well. And so I want to talk a little bit about a portion of the El Paso Shooter Manifesto he references, where he talks about the shootings that happened earlier this year in New Zealand. There was yet also a manifesto posted online that talked about the Great Replacements. They happened in Whitechurch. And in New Zealand, this manifesto was banned. And I think it was actually pretty interesting, notable. David Shanks, the chief censor in New Zealand's Department of Internal Affairs, who basically is the guy who decided to ban this, said, there is an important distinction to be made between hate speech, which may be rejected by many right-thinking people, but which is legal to express, and this type of publication, which is deliberately constructed to inspire further murder and terrorism, and frankly appears to have done so. David Shanks said, it crosses the line. Related to that, we saw either this morning or yesterday, Cloudflare, which is the internet company that hosts 8chan, where the El Paso manifesto was posted, decided that they were not going to host 8chan anymore. The quote from the current CEO of Cloudflare says, actually very similar.
was we reluctantly tolerate content that we find reprehensible, but we draw the line at platforms that have demonstrated they directly inspire tragic events and are lawless by design. 8chan has crossed that line. Yet again, hate speech, you know, we don't like it, but we'll tolerate it. But this is something else. This is more than hate speech. This is trying, this is an intentional effort to incite violence. Catherine, we've talked a lot, so much about deplatforming on this podcast. We've had some disagreements, I think, amongst the panelists. How do you feel about this? I think obviously the New Zealand banning it as a sort of a government policy is different from the a web hosting company declining to host something. But how do we feel about this sort of deplatforming and the distinction that is being drawn here between hate speech, which is regrettable, but we're going to tolerate it, and incitements of violence like these manifestos are?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple things going on here. The first is absolutely the distinction you draw, which is like to ban something, to have someone whose title is censored, dear God, actually ban a chunk of words that someone wants to say is, I think, you know, a clearer, brighter line where we can just say like, nope, we're against that. That's a thing we're against that thing. I do think, though, the Cloudflare example is interesting because it's there's a like a subtle technical element to this. So Cloudflare wasn't actually even the host of the 8chan content. They were providing DDoS protection, right? And so there's the internet is complicated. It takes lots of different companies to support the existence of something online. And any of those companies can withdraw their support of that specific thing. And I think in this case, I understand the thinking and you know, this is something that they had previously established as a pattern. They had explicitly cited their decision to, you know, to withdraw their services from Stormfront before. In their description, though, as Elizabeth Nolan Brown and others at Reason have pointed out, they also note that that didn't work. Despite their choice to not be service providers, that content is still available online. We're sitting here with the manifesto open on our computer screens right now in order to do this podcast. The notion that individual companies withdrawing their services is the same thing as censorship is, I think, a dangerous one and one that we should explicitly, you know, contradict. One we should explicitly say, companies can do whatever they want. A government ban is bad. Have at it in the middle ground.
The Cloudflare CEO, in fact, seemed to say in his message that he didn't think that this would do anything other than relieve pressure on them specifically. He wrote that while removing 8chan from our network takes the heat off us, it does nothing to address why hateful sites fester online, does nothing to address why mass shootings occur, it does nothing to address why portions of the population feel so disenchanted in taking this action. We've solved our own problem, but we haven't solved the internet's. And in some ways, I think he's sort of largely right about the lack of solution here, the fact that this doesn't solve a lot of things, but he seems to be calling for something like a public policy solution as well. Nick, I want to ask you, why have First Amendment issues suddenly become part of the policy discussion in the aftermath of mass shootings? I mean, you go back to Columbine, you go back to when the school shootings were starting to happen in the late 1990s and early aughts, it was basically just about Second Amendment issues. But as the internet has taken over, sort of become more central to every part of life, it really seems like First Amendment issues have come to the fore when it comes to mass shootings. Why do you think that is? Is it basically just that the internet is now sort of the dominant battleground for public policy, or is there something else?
I think that's a huge part of it. And it's also because the internet is ultimately a collection of private organizations or private platforms, whether you're talking about Twitter or Facebook, or, you know, particular web services that are hosting things. And they have a right to say, you know, we don't want to be part of this. So you have that. You also have a growing sense, and this is something that Donald Trump this morning tweeted about, how fake news somehow was partly responsible for the El Paso and the Dayton shootings, because there's so much bad news out there. And you have increasingly conservatives talking about the internet, broadly speaking, as the new public square, and hence, you know, and they feel like they are not getting a fair shake on it. So they are calling for, you know, government regulation of these public spaces. So it becomes a very confusing kind of argument, where I think we would be better off talking about how do you change a kind of broad-based civil conversation that goes on, you know, as opposed to using the means of government, of censorship, you know, in order to do this. But we're getting to that point where where every, you know, the internet is being treated like old broadcast networks, that somehow there is some kind of role for government in regulating and restricting speech that we don't like or promoting speech that we want to see. And that's going to change with whoever is in power. And I think it's not a good development. Having said that, there is the question of how do you restrict, how do you minimize places where actual incitement to violence is happening? And this is also something that is distinct from hate speech. And I think we still have a pretty clear distinction in the United States between hate speech or ugly speech and incitements to violence or fighting words and things like that. And we, you know, we need to be talking more about the, what those distinctions are, but also how do you squeeze down the places where people are actually calling for violence. And, you know, that is, you know, it's not an easy solution. It's not an on-off switch or anything like that. But I think, you know, the president's rhetoric in particular, you know, both in terms of being racist a couple of weeks ago and then dehumanizing constantly about invaders, you know, who are immigrants and things like that. These are things that we should be calling out and saying we want less of this.
Although I also, I mean, to me, the most interesting piece of this is the automation, the anti-automation rhetoric. Both be
he's actually pro-automation, though, or the shooter was pro-automation in the manifesto.
He's sort of concerned about automation.
He's worried about people losing jobs.
He has semi-coherent views on automation.
He's pro-automation because it will reduce the need for low-wage immigrants.
I mean,
he says the
job of my dreams will likely be automated. That doesn't sound like unambiguously
pro. And that the world that he's grown up expecting is no longer going to be
there. My whole life I've been preparing for a future that currently doesn't exist. I mean, I think, you know, I think, but I actually think the
we
fact
also
that
shouldn't
we,
expect intellectual consistency from this guy.
But the
either.
Fact like, that looking at this, we can sort of see that automation is a bugaboo for this guy. We can see that it's on his mind. He bothered to put it in his manifesto. And yet the way that automation interacts with immigration is confusing. And it's confusing for policymakers, and it's confusing for social scientists who have not done a very good job often of disentangling the effects of those two trends on unemployment, particularly unemployment for low education, white, native born men. And I think to me that signals more than anything that what we're seeing here is part of a broader conversation that Donald Trump is a part of, that Orrin Cass is a part of, that the conservative nationalists are a part of. Automation is the thing that comes
Elizabeth
up.
Warren is part of, and Bernie Sanders.
Well, Elizabeth
Sanders
Warren
as well.
And the nationalist conservatives agree on this matter. And I guess I'm just interested what you guys think, and you've already chimed in a little bit on this, but like, why is automation at the top of his personal reasons and thoughts section of this manifesto? What is it doing there? Is it just, you know, does this just take us back to a baseline hopelessness that a certain demographic in the United States is experiencing, or is something else going on?
I think, you know, part of that, and I'm looking at his manifesto now, the automation stuff, automation is a good thing as it will eliminate the need for new migrants to fill unskilled jobs, jobs that Americans can't survive on anyway, et cetera. And then he goes through, you know, various things about that. That's all in the context of corporations, multinational corporations that don't care about America or Americans. And so there's this broader critique of, you know, essentially what he is doing is he's encapsulating the argument that Donald Trump used to get elected, and he's encapsulating the argument that I think Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders also talk about, that the middle class is getting left behind, that there are very few people who are doing phenomenally well and everybody else is getting screwed. And then you have this invasion from abroad, both in terms of foreign goods, but then foreign workers who are coming here and driving down racial diversity. I mean, it's obviously it's the work of a madman and it's confused, but he is essentially, you know, kind of doing a word salad version of the typical critique of American society, which is that economic gains are going to very few people. The system is rigged and there is no future.
Yeah, I think it's dangerous to look too deeply into this for meaning, though, because I mean, there are just so many internal contradictions. And basically, I mean, what Nick just said is right. This is word salad version of what you could hear on any cable news network on any given night from hosts, both left and right, primarily right, unfortunately, I think. But I mean, you could really hear this from either side. He's taking some of it further than people would typically go in a public forum. But, you know, it doesn't make any sense. sense. He talks, on one hand, obviously so much of this is anti-immigrant and about the replacement of Americans and all of that. But then on the other hand, he also points out near the end of it that many immigrants have been here at least as long as whites, and they have much to do. They've done much to build our country. The best solution for now would be to divide America into a confederacy of territory. I mean, it just goes off in sort of like crazy tangents. And so I don't know that we should pay much more attention to this than you would pay to the average YouTube comment, just because it happens to be longer and because it was followed by a horrific mass shooting. One other point, I know Catherine wants to jump in here, but one other point, going back to our conversation a few minutes ago about the First Amendment, pulling this sort of content down or shutting down 8chan or whatever ends up being kind of the policy response here does have some negative externalities in a sense. The police actually had this document and they were aware that this was a potentially dangerous situation. They unfortunately did not put all the pieces together in time, and the fact that the shooter was actually from a suburb of Dallas but drove all the way to El Paso to carry out his attack made it more difficult for them to stop.
If I understand correctly, they only had it for 19 minutes before the shooting happened?
Sure, but having a forum on the internet where this type of warning signs, these, you know, red lights could be flashing for law enforcement before something happens, I think is probably better than not having it or having it buried deeper in the dark web or something like that.
Catherine, did you have something you wanted to add here?
I think we can kind of wrap back around to the First Amendment point, because I do think it's actually the most important one in the live conversation right now. I think, despite my general pessimism about Donald Trump and gun control, I think the more likely significant shift, which is already underway in some corners of the internet, will be a crackdown on speech. I think the New Zealand example is an extreme one, and they have a different underlying system there. But that there are many, many forces, bipartisan forces, that will be looking to create a category of prohibited speech that is larger than our current very, very, very small category of prohibited speech. And I don't think that that will be to the good.
And if we want to get into more potentially dangerous government reactions to this or overreactions, apparently the president in his remarks this morning that happened while we were recording this says that those who commit hate crimes should face the death penalty without years of endless delay. That's coming from Mark Knoller of CBS News, who tweets that just a few minutes ago. So, more death penalty for hate crimes. That sounds great, doesn't it, for
sure.
Libertarians?
I don't know. It feels to me like you should be able to prosecute people pretty hard for murdering 20 people.
For murdering 20 people, that's
true. Regardless of why they did it.
This is a position that I think all of us on this podcast hold, perhaps to varying degrees of extremity, but that, broadly speaking, Americans don't agree with us on. And that is something that's worth keeping in mind. People think motives matter in crimes, and our legal system does treat motives as relevant in many cases in determining punishment. And that, in particular, this thing that's called hate speech, that's an idea that is increasingly prevalent in all aspects of society, matters and should be taken into account. Now, the particular Trump formulation, of course, is especially pernicious because it's like a mandatory minimum and a explicit abrogation of
Trump
due
is
process.
Basically saying, right,
so
let's
congratulations,
shorten,
Donald Trump
let's
has
grease
done
the skids on due process.
The worst, the
so
worst
they can kill more
version
people.
Of a bad idea.
So Donald Trump, not great for a lot of things, including
not a libertarian,
not so
shockingly.
Much a libertarian.
Breaking news.
We've only got a couple of minutes left here, so I want to switch topics just a little bit. Donald Trump has made it hard to be a lot of things in this country, among them a Republican in Congress, and in particular, a black Republican in Congress. Representative Will Hurd of Texas announced he was retiring last week. He was the only black member of a Republican black member of the House. And he is one of seven or eight Republicans who have announced their retirements already. There are probably more to come this year to take back the House next year, which would be historically unlikely. I believe that the House has not flipped on a presidential election year since sometime in the early 1950s. To take back the House, Republicans will need to flip 19 seats that are under Democratic control. And that just doesn't seem like it's going to happen. At the exact same time, virtually, that Will Hurd announced his retirement, the Senate also signed yet another budget-busting budget deal that broke the caps that were put in place under the Tea Party, under Obama, the signature achievement of the Tea Party. I think these things are related. And so, Eric, I just want to ask you about this a little bit. First of all, is there anything left of the Tea Party's legacy? And is that entirely Donald Trump's fault? Or are there other forces going on?
I think that's largely Donald Trump's fault. I always do, you know, come back to this, like, is he the cause or the effect thing? And it's a little bit of both again. But I think that's largely a result of him taking over the party and being someone who obviously doesn't have a lot of concern for fiscal issues. Although it's worth pointing out, he did during the campaign. He played, you know, he paid lip service to the idea that he would handle the debt and deficit. He promised sort of ludicrously that he would pay off the national debt within 8 years, which is nonsense. I think he probably meant he was going to get the eliminate the deficit in 8 years, which is also very, very difficult to do, but maybe would have been doable. Now it's virtually, it's certainly impossible to be done now after he signed a budget busting bill last year, said at the time he wouldn't sign another one that spent that much money and did that sort of damage to the deficit, and then turned around and signed this new spending package just last week. This guarantees trillion-dollar deficits for the foreseeable future. We were probably already there anyway. This will make it worse. It will make it much harder for any future administration or Congress to corral the deficit. It does nothing to address the real long-term drivers here, which are the entitlement spending, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, that are really driving that long-term deficit problem that we have. And it is a complete abdication of any sort of fiscal responsibility. The Tea Party is effectively dead, to answer your question. Justin Amash is still in Congress. Thomas Massey is still there. So there's a couple remnants, I guess, of that. But I think maybe the best explanation, and one that I've heard from former Tea Party congressmen's staffers, it goes back to something that Thomas Massey said a couple of years ago. And that is that, you know, he thought at the time when these guys were getting elected in 2010 and 2012, that Republican voters were voting for fiscal conservatism and small government. And actually, they were just voting for the craziest son of a bitch in the room. And I think Trump's election bears that out. And I think everything we've seen since Trump's election continues to bear that out, that American politics is sort of being driven by the crazies on either side, and that it's not really, you know, fiscal conservatism might sound crazy in certain environments, and certainly it doesn't seem like it's the thing that's driving politics at the moment, though.
Always worth throwing in a to be sure here that the only possible configuration of presidency and Congress that would increase the debt and deficit more than the current Republican heavy configuration is a Democrat heavy configuration. That is, you know, something that it's easy to lose sight of when there's a hypocrisy angle with Republicans. That's typically not there with Democrats. Republicans, a hot minute ago, at least sometimes said words that sometimes sounded like maybe they cared about this issue. Democrats, on the other hand, are fully now into the phase of, well, I don't know, you just pay for it. And they are
during the debate last week. Long, Republican talking point is what they said. Any question about
the idea of asking any of their rivals on stage for the Democratic nomination, the asking the question, how would you pay for that? What would the trade-offs be? What was decried as a Republican talking point? Oh, the irony, given that Republicans haven't talked that point in years. But here we are.
Nick, I actually want to ask you about that, because it's not a Republican talking point. It used to be, I actually think it used to be a Democratic talking point. Bill Clinton bragged about having brought the deficit down to effectively zero, or certainly the lowest it has been in my lifetime. President Obama ran very high deficits during his first term, but actually brought them down during the second term, at least made a token kind of fake effort to offset the cost of Obamacare. Like, it was important to get it through Congress that they could say it was paid for. President Obama had the super committee and, of course, rejected its findings, but did say, look, the entitlements are the biggest drivers of the long-term debt. Nick, why has the Democratic Party just completely abandoned this and the Republican Party kind of at the same time? Why are we seeing this plague of fiscal irresponsibility in both parties right now?
Yeah, I was going to say that I think the important thing is to look at this as a bipartisan or a transpartisan or a, you know, postpartisan issue that is tied into a larger decline narrative about America, where it's almost, and this is, you know, one of the ways that Trump was elected was by talking about how terrible America was, and about, you know, remember, particularly just in terms of things like street crime, he was talking about America as if it was the mid-1970s, not, you know, a period where we're actually seeing lower crime rates than we've seen you know, since the 60s, and more broadly about, industrialization had been wiped out. You know, people were going begging for jobs, et cetera, coming out of the financial crisis. Democrats are also like that, where we are telling a series of stories about ourselves, where there is just virtually nothing good going on in America. And then what politicians do is they say, well, we'll bring it back by spending this or this or doing this or that. And I think we're now in a place where it's as if we're so close to going down the drain that all of the normal constraints no longer matter. And you see that on the most extreme side, on people in on the left of the Democratic Party, where they're saying, you know, people like AOC, that we, you know, the planet's going to end in 12 years. So, like, why would you be worrying about how to pay for something? Because we need to stop the world from being destroyed. And on the Republican side, Donald Trump thinks about the world in apocalyptic terms. He talks about it, and he has brought the Republican Party over to his side. Nobody is thinking about what happens in 25 years or in 30 years or in 50 years with, I mean, they probably never talk about that with any seriousness, but everybody is acting as if we are on, you know, code red, and everything is about to go, all of the lights are about to go out all over the place. And as a result, you don't think about that stuff.
All right. So speaking of telling stories, then I want to go to our prime story time last week, which was the Democratic debates. We had yet another doubleheader. And since we don't have time to talk about it in great detail, but I just want to go around a little bit and ask everyone in a kind of a lightning round fashion, what stood out to you? I will go first, and I will just say Kamala Harris couldn't defend the healthcare plan yet again. She had put out a healthcare plan earlier in the week that was designed to make sense of all of her incoherent rhetoric that didn't make any sense. And then once again, when she got pressed on it, in particular by Joe Biden, she was like, yeah, it sort of requires you to not, it sort of requires employers to not offer plans anymore, but maybe it doesn't. That's a lie. She just had no idea how to talk about this. It really showed, I think, one of her weaknesses, which is that when it comes to the details of policy, she is kind of a lightweight. Eric, do you want to go next?
Yeah, and I guess I would add to that that she also couldn't defend her record when Tulsi Gabbard went after her on that. So, I mean, she did not have a good debate. What stood out to me, and I did not watch the first debate, so I only saw the second one. What stood out to me was I thought Cory Booker had a really good debate, kind of surprisingly, because he's been a sort of afterthought candidate for a while. He went after Biden in a much more effective way than we've seen Harris do in either of the two debates where she's shared the stage with Biden. I'm curious to see whether that will help him in the polls. I think this race ultimately comes down to a centrist versus a leftist for the Democratic Party. The centrist is obviously going to be Biden. He's going to be playing the role of Hillary Clinton from the last election. There's a debate right now going on over whether it will be Bernie Sanders reprising the role of Bernie Sanders from 2016, or whether, as I think, it'll be Elizabeth Warren, who ultimately kind of eats his lunch and takes that lefty role. And then I think once you get all the chaff out of the way, I think there will ultimately be a third major candidate who emerges as sort of a wild card for Democratic voters who are disenchanted with Biden for various reasons. He's too old, he's too white, he's too male, whatever it might be, but also are not ready to go full Sanders, Warren, lefty. And so I think right now, Harris and Booker are probably the two most likely. Maybe, there's a few other candidates I guess I could throw in there too. But I think this probably comes down to being a Biden versus Warren race with a third wild card candidate. And I think Booker made a really good pitch this week for making himself that wild card candidate, if you will.
Nick, what stood out from the debates to you?
You know, ultimately, it was that the Democrats don't have a good story to tell about the state of America or what they're going to do, because most of the stuff that people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are proposing are really beyond what people want. And you can see that even in the Kamala Harris, you know, part of her problem is that she can't get it straight whether or not she wants to get rid of private insurance or not. And there's a lot of that going on. But the further left you go, the more they're proposing things that are not going to be very popular, even among Democrats, much less the general population. And the other thing that stood out was that the Obama years, partly because everybody was attacking Biden, the Obama years were characterized in that debate as a kind of awful period where we were doing stupid wars, we were doing stupid kind of immigration policy, the economy wasn't really working for anybody. And so it feeds more into this kind of declinist narrative, which is pretty much at odds with most things that are happening in America, where standards of living continue to get better, the economy keeps expanding and things like that. And it's just this broad disconnect I find incredibly disconcerting, because it creates a lot of despair to be saying that the United States is, you know, slipping into a worse and worse state where nobody can get ahead. No, nothing works. Everybody is upset. If you're a minority, you're upset because of white supremacy. If you're white, you're upset because you're being invaded. The economy isn't working, etc. You know, this is not a good set of stories to be told. And there is a right-wing version that Donald Trump is telling, and there's a left-wing version that the Democrats are telling. And it doesn't end well. We need a different story to be talking about what's going on right now.
Catherine, what story do you want to tell?
My story is more of a question, which is like John Delaney question mark? Like, I don't know.
Like dot question mark?
Yeah, there's a lot of punctuation in my story. And I think it's, you know, I don't have a huge amount of deeply insightful analysis, except for to say I was struck in real time by his remarks, which were, you know, to my mind, the sanest and most measured on the stage for much of the night. I was also struck in the immediate aftermath by how very, very few people shared that take on John Delaney. The same people, you know, people who I often respect their judgment and trust, watching the same debate, who thought that he seemed insane and unmoored. But the quote that jumped out at me was him saying on Tuesday night that, you know, everyone else is supporting Medicare for all, and that, in fact, maybe this isn't about healthcare. Maybe it's an anti-private sector strategy, which was really saying the loud part quiet and the quiet part loud kind of moment for the Democratic Party. And he had a couple other good moments where he was sort of speaking truth to power, if power is Bernie Sanders, which it sort of is in the Democratic Party. So I guess my takeaway is, how did that John Delaney guy get up on stage? How was he allowed to say those things? And will we ever see him again?
I think part of what makes him interesting to us, to you, to me, is that he is one of the few, maybe the only Democratic candidate who has run a successful company. And in particular, he ran a healthcare financing company in the early 1990s. Before we get to our whatcha watchin' and consumin' recommendations, I just want to ask Eric very quickly to run us through an issue that is important to people who own, run, and work for companies, or even just buy stuff from them, the trade war truce that started earlier this summer with China is now over. Eric, give us the latest.
Yeah, or it's not. It's not over maybe yet, but it's certainly heading towards being over. President Donald Trump last week announced that basically everything that we import from China that's not currently subject to tariffs, that's about $300 billion worth of annual imports, will be subject to tariffs of 10% starting on September 1st. This is the same threat that he made late last year with a deadline of March 1st, and that deadline came and passed, and the administration did nothing about it. At the time, there were ongoing conversations with China over a trade deal, and so it looked like maybe the good feelings of that negotiation had convinced the administration to put off those tariffs or postpone them. It appears, I guess, now that the administration or the president himself is not happy with the way those negotiations are going, and so he's setting this new deadline. Of course, the important caveat here, China doesn't pay those tariffs. Americans do. American consumers, American businesses will ultimately be the ones paying that 10% tariff on September 1st if it goes into effect, just like American consumers and businesses are already paying the existing 25% tariffs on the other roughly $250 billion worth of imported goods. This is, and I think some of the reporting that came out last week about this is that the president made this decision very brashly, sort of a snap decision that was made while the advisors who were giving him an update on the negotiations with China were still in the room. And one of them, Robert Lighthizer, who runs the office of the U.S. Trade Representative, apparently or allegedly reportedly wanted to give China a heads up, as you would probably do if you were engaged in a negotiation with a major trading partner before you would announce these new tariffs. He wanted to tell the Chinese trade delegation, at least, that the president would be making this announcement. And Trump overruled him and immediately fired out on Twitter this announcement of new tariffs, probably pulling out the rug from under whatever sort of negotiation or deal was in progress or is in progress. It's very unclear at this point whether any sort of deal is going to be made. In fact, a number of White House advisors in recent weeks have expressed openly skepticism that a trade deal with China will ever be made. So I think, yeah, we're going to see an escalation of the trade war. China's going to hit back. And this is just the world that we live in right now with regard to U.S.-Chinese relations. It's, I think, a dangerous place for this relationship to be, and one that certainly doesn't make so many of the other issues, defense issues and other sort of related things, any easier to work out.
And with that, we will move on to our final segment, what you watching, what you consuming, reading, otherwise putting into your brain. And so since you mentioned China and the U.S.-China relationship, I will start.
That's a segue. Making Matt Welsh proud.
I saw the new Fast and the Furious spinoff film Hobbs and Shaw over the weekend. It had a $180 million opening weekend, the majority of which was a foreign box office, not yet in China, but when it opens in China, it's probably going to be huge because these movies are at this point not quite entirely an international and China phenomenon, but very close. I will just note that the last Fast and the Furious film, The Fate of the Furious, that would be the eighth one, made about $225 million in the United States and over $1 billion globally, including nearly $400 million in China. These are movies that are made to appeal to a global audience. They are stylish, sort of ridiculous, international action films, which is fascinating given where they started as these like cheap B movies about cars, and they're made so that it almost doesn't matter what words are being said on the screen. You can always tell exactly what's happening just by kind of like if the movie, I kept watching it and I was thinking, you know, there's a little bit of clever dialogue here and there, but if this movie were in Chinese and there were no English subtitles, I would know basically as much as I know already. It's not a great movie, but it's kind of an interesting movie. And it's not. So some of the Fast and Furious movies are really quite clever for what they are. This one, I think, is a little bit weaker. But I would recommend to you my friend Alyssa Rosenberg's piece in The Washington Post, where she wrote up the movie as being not so great, but interesting as an example of so many different cultural phenomena that are, especially with regard to film, coming together all at once. She has a really smart piece up. Nick, what were you watching, reading, otherwise consuming last week?
The movie that I saw, actually, and this has a Chinese connection as well, I saw The Farewell, the movie directed by Lulu Wang and starring Awkwafina, who's probably best known as a rapper and an actress. And it's about an American girl who was born in China, raised in America, and then goes back with her parents under the guise of a wedding to say goodbye to their grandmother, her grandmother, who doesn't know that she's dying of cancer, is diagnosed with terminal cancer. And it's set a record, at least briefly, where in limited release, it had a higher per screen average than even the latest Avengers movie, which had set a record on that. So it's something of a phenomenon. And it's a fantastic movie. And to tie it back into some of the stuff that we're talking about, one of the things that's amazing about it, much of the movie is in Chinese, but it's a profoundly American movie about growing up in a foreign country and becoming Americanized as well as still having roots. And I think in a lot of ways, it's a really, really deeply moving kind of meditation on mortality, as well as what it means to live in a world where you have access to the globe, and that where everybody is increasingly made up of different ethnic and regional and geographic identities, as well as also class identities in many ways. And it's the type of movie that might help us actually kind of reconfigure how we think about the contemporary world and get out of a funk. It's a melancholy movie that is also uplifting at the same time. And I highly recommend it to everybody.
I guess since we're staying on the China theme here, I'll mention that I just finished reading a few weeks ago The Three Body Problem, which is, I think, the most widely sold sci-fi book in China. History, written by a Chinese author, and sort of deals with the Cultural Revolution and also first contact with an alien world, and is a very like Arthur C. Clarke kind of style of it's not aliens coming down and sitting over our cities and threatening us, or, you know, take us to your leader kind of stuff. It all happens across space and time via interesting, you know, multidimensional communication and the ability to send particles across space instantaneously. It also is a book that deals very much with the question of time, the alien invasion that is coming to conquer us, that the alien world has to figure out. It's going to take them something like 400 years to get here, and they are concerned at one point in the story about how far human society will advance in the next 400 years, and they come up with a clever solution because their, you know, their technology that they're sending will not obviously advance in the 400 years that it is in transit. So they're worried that it will get here and be wiped out by far superior humanity. And there's a cool sort of clever reaction to that in there as well. That's cool. So, yeah. And it's also going to be adapted into an Amazon or HBO series, I believe, in the near future. It's in the process of being adapted.
That whole trilogy is fantastic. I wrote about it for a reason a few years ago. And if you read the later books, it really becomes an examination of the Chinese surveillance state and the ways that the Chinese surveillance state is kind of dehumanizing and yet a person with a strong individualistic core can avoid it simply by maintaining their own, right, by sort of being themselves inside their own mind. Catherine, what piece of Chinese culture did you consume last week?
I am still reading the books of the Babaverse by Dennis Taylor. This is the first one is We Are Legion. There are several others. There is a little Chinese vibe in some of them. There's some semi-inexplicable Mandarin being spoken by various aliens. So I feel like I can wrap it up. But since we do try to bring a fresh recommendation every week, I feel like it's not very satisfying to be like still reading them books, even though that is the reality of reading. In case you listeners were wondering, like, are we all consuming media at an absolutely insane rate?
Yes.
Yes. But like, we do sometimes take more than 1 minute to finish a book. But I do not want to leave you recommendation lists from me. So I will recommend a New Yorker profile came out about a month ago about Hunter Biden, called Will Hunter Biden Jeopardize His Father's Campaign by Adam Entus.
Does this follow the question rule for headlines?
Yeah, it does. It really, really does. Oh, no, it doesn't, I guess, because you're supposed to be the answer is no, right?
And the answer here is yep.
The answer here is yeah, def. Big time. It's a very interesting profile, interesting both for the information it contains about the Biden family and especially Hunter, but also as an exercise in profile writing, the fact that the author has quite a bit of access to Hunter Biden and that Hunter has sort of spilled his guts to this author in some ways is introduced late in the piece, very delicately, and makes for a very interesting and sympathetic read in a piece that is full of, frankly, not great revelations about Biden's personal life, on which much of his campaign is currently resting. He's a grumpy old man that people are lightly annoyed about, who's a squishy moderate. People really like his family story of overcoming tragedy. This piece raises the question about exactly how much overcoming there really was.
And with that, we are finished for this week. Thank you so much for listening. Please remember to rate and review us, subscribe, tell your friends, tell your family. Make sure everyone you know listens to the Reason Editors podcast. Thank you so much, and we're done.